This is CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto Community Radio Station, broadcasting live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from Heart House, University of Toronto.
Come on, everybody, come on the floor. Guys, all right, you know what I'm
Collective CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Jams. Joining me in studio, my co-hosts.
Mally, a.k.a. DocuVixen.
Adrian Worrell.
Kemba King.
And Adnan Hussein. Hello.
Hello. Kemba's having some technical difficulties with her mic stand.
Yeah. Just hold the mic.
I'm weak. That's what all that was about. Thank you, Adnan.
I just had the finest moment of my week.
And it's okay. Another week.
It is. It's another week. We are the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we have roundtable discussions. We talk about important issues like social justice, decolonization, the culture of resistance, identity, hip-hop, art, love. And then from 4 to 5, one of the resident DJs, brings you music to move you. And we will be doing that today.
Yay.
Yeah. And we might have a guest. Maybe.
I'm sure we will. I think with the traffic that's going on, and I know that there are people listening far and wide in different time zones. So I know that the public transit system, or even, I don't know how our guest is getting here, but it's a bit slow. It even took me a bit longer to get here today. So
yeah.
But we really want to talk about education today, and I hate this term, but alternative models of education. Mm-hmm. And I believe all of us are educators in some form in this room, so I'm sure it will be a lively discussion.
Yeah,
definitely. What are some other terms we could use besides alternative? Anybody? Okay, dead air.
I remember I'm going to say something,
sorry,
Brett.
I almost had something, but you know, it depends, I think, on the orientation of the education. So if it is centered on the student, then it kind of fits more into this kind of model of, what did Fieri use? Pedagogy of the oppressed is what he called it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I really like that term because it's got fancy words in it and it has oppression built right in. But I think that when it's centered on students, it kind of destabilizes that standard narrative of like, I as the teacher have all the knowledge and I'll kind of met it out to you as I see fit,
mm-hmm.
Or meet it out to you. And I think the shift in that standard narrative is really important for education because it allows you as the educator to learn as well and to kind of be unabashed in your learning.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is here. Wonderful.
Hooray.
And I think a more models that do not fit within the dominant are focusing on children as the center. So I think what I'm going to do as our guest settles in is share his bio for all the people who are waiting and listening. And so Colwyn Birchall Jr. has a Bachelor of Arts and a Magistrate of Education. He is a freelance writer, a public speaker, a literacy specialist, and a stay-at-home father of two high-energy irrepressibly brilliant African boys. He's the author of Look for Me in the Whirlwind, A Story of Marcus Garvey, Freedom's Flames, Slavery in Bermuda, and The True Story of Sally Bassett. And Dame Lois, the people's advocate, his love of history as well as his desire to share the stories of global luminaries with young people inspires him to bring these great men and women to life for the benefit of future generations. So,
wow, that's quite an impressive bio.
I really should have read that aloud to myself before this. And I'm really happy that Junior's here because we have people in common, mm-hmm. and we've been in cyberspace together and physical space together, but we haven't had a chance to vibe and reason. So this is really an exciting moment when he is settled in with us to talk with us.
Yeah, definitely. It's the same thing. We've been trying to get him on the show for a minute now, and it's good to have him in person, in the flesh. He's just about to roll in, and we will be discussing, as you said, we'll be looking at different methodologies for educating, in particular if you're doing that at home. And yeah, go ahead and just slam that door. Yes, welcome. Oh, yes, welcome to the Vibe Collective.
It's all, see, like, the locks. I don't know, like, Adrian's got it, like, down, but, like, every week it's, like, this thing, so.
Yeah, trying to make room for the headphones right. over your locks.
That's what I'm going to design.
Oh.
Headphone-friendly, I mean, locks-friendly headphones.
Yes.
We need to work on that.
Yeah. So I guess, as you settle in, Junior, the first thing I actually really wanted you to speak about is, and I guess this is a past and present question, mm-hmm. How has your definitions of maybe masculinity evolved? Because I think that's an important part of this conversation as a father and as an educator.
How has my definition of masculinity changed? One thing that I know is that my understanding of masculinity isn't anymore, because it once was wrapped up in notions of physical power and the ability to exercise some form of coercive control over people. It's also, for me, becoming a father has forced me to confront many of the demons associated with my own underdeveloped sense of what manhood was, much of which was associated with my ability to sexually conquer women, to be athletic, you know, things that were taken to be the stuff that all men, all young men in my era, we would strive to achieve. Mm. We wanted to be, you know, the coxman, the sportsman, or something of that nature. And so I was striving for those goals. You know, I wanted to get the most women. I wanted to be the best player on the football field and things like that. And I wanted to be known for that and celebrated for that. But that doesn't help one to develop healthy relationships with women. And it leaves you, in many respects, emotionally underdeveloped. Mm. So I had to, as I became a father of two boys, May 28th, 2004, I was confronted with this little male child who would be looking to me for some form of healthy manhood that would help him to traverse a very hostile, hateful society. Mm. Now, what would I have to work with? I would definitely need some redefinitions of what I understood masculinity to be, because all of those things that I listed, the idea of, you know, conquering and being coerced, having coercive power over others, tend to lead to very bad outcomes for African boys, especially. Mm. You know, the idea that your manhood is so fragile an object that the mere slight could lead to some really explosive situations that sometimes could take you all the way to death.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to, I guess, get right into it. So I imagine that was the point wherein you made a decision to, I guess, in a significant way, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, change your definitions of masculinity. What was the point at which you made the decision that the current dominant school system was not a place in which you wanted your children to be, not just educated, but socialized within?
Well, it didn't work for me. Oh. And I don't know too many black folk, if we're going to be brutally honest, or non-white folk, period, who found, or white folk for that matter, who found school to be some sort of place where they learned how to be healthy human beings. We learn how to conquer. We learn what's cool. We learn, we get a deep understanding of the importance of the performance of heterosexuality. We know exactly what the hell a fag is by the time we leave elementary school. We know also that that's a very, very, very bad thing. And we also understand that, you know, kowtowing to oppressive authority in the form of, you know, a teacher or principal in order to get those little stickers and those A grades is, you know, that's really the whole point. The point isn't learning. The point is conquering these tests and collecting those little A grades and going on to the next level, which has little to do with developing the human being, very little to do with that. So in reflecting on my own academic experience and realizing that I mastered the art of cheating by the time I left elementary school, I was really, really good at that. In fact, all of the kids I went to school were really good at that. I realized that for us, if we wanted to do something different, it wouldn't make a lot of sense sticking our children into an academic, so-called learning environment where these norms are so dysfunctional. You know, the expectation of cliquishness and all sorts of dysfunctional things that we didn't want to see our children exposed to.
One of the things I saw you post today, speaking of knowing you virtually, on your Facebook, actually, I just want to pull it up because it was really poignant to me as a mother and as somebody who, you know, I feel very strongly about what you had to say here. I'm just going to pull it up here, and it's related to educating your sons at home. We don't do Afrocentric school at home with a trailer load of culturally specific books and worksheets and such. Instead, it's all about critical conversations, groundings with our cubs, where we reason about capitalism, African participation in the white supremacist oppression of our people, the cult of Obama, and the dangers associated with elevating pigment over practice, patriarchy, sexual orientation, the deeper significance of mooning, the menstrual cycle, the use of the color black in children's movies, spirituality, really whatever comes up. For us, it's about nurturing the questioning mind and for grounding three foundational questions. Is that true? Why is that? And is that in the best interests of African people? Having paid attention to your posts for a while now and seeing, you know, some of the questions that you are discussing with your sons. As a mother, it's really inspiring because, you know, I have my child has been in the miseducation system, and I wasn't able to do home schooling but certainly critical conversation has been a constant in our home as well. Are you following a particular type of curriculum that you have in your own mind, or what is guiding this sort of critical engagement with your sons at home?
Well, first and foremost, I presume my son's intelligence. Mm. I presume that. I take it for granted that he is thinking, you know, and it's borne out in the questions that he would ask. I trust that deeply. I really believe that our children come out thinking. They come out thirsting for knowledge. They come out asking questions. And in too many instances, school is designed to smother that natural curiosity that leads to greater insight. Well, I don't follow, just as it was said in the post that you just read, I don't follow any curriculum. That being said, can my son write an essay? Yeah. Can he read? Well, he can read actually better than most adults, I know. But I don't consider those to be indicators of his intelligence or his academic progress, anything like that. I want to know, what are you thinking about the world that you're in? What principles are you adhering to? What informs the way you see the world? I think those are much more important questions to ask than to follow some pre-designed curriculum, you know, where we go from A to Z, but instead of being covered in, I don't know, the maple leaf, it's covered in the red, black, and green. I don't see the benefit of that for the two sons, the two boys that I'm working with. And the questions are literally, like, they come from everywhere. Like, Omari, my 8-year-old, just discovered the wonders of the moon cycle.
Love it.
And so we had, so he's coming downstairs. Oh, my wife's going to be listening to this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he's coming downstairs and he's like, you know, he has this slightly confused look on his face, cause he's, and he comes to me and says, "Dad, women bleed?" I was like, "Yeah." They bleed every month?" I was like, "Yeah, they do." And he was confused, cause he's like, when he bleeds, like, he had a little nick on his scalp, and that's associated with injury and stuff like that. So we had this really involved discussion about what that means and the sacredness of it, because I also wanted him to grasp that, you know, there ain't nothing dirty about the period. It's not a curse. It's a blessing. And we are actually here because of the woman's ability to bear the fruit that is humankind. So it's a blessing to be a part of that, and there's nothing dirty or confusing or vulgar about that. So we were able to go all sorts of places, and then he went back to reading his graphic novel. But, you know, in demystifying this, it's very much like it can be improvisational in the way that a jazz score is improvisational, the way Kind of Blue by Miles J is, like, he threw it in. And but you have to have some sort of understanding of the conversations that might come up. So I've thought about, you know, the importance of the divine feminine. I've thought about it deeply. And then the challenge beyond that is, how then do you make that tangible to somebody who still sometimes pees the bed? A lot of our understanding of Afrocentricity, for need of a better word, came to us usually in late high school, sometimes in university. So we would encounter people like Giap or Walter Rodney and these other scholars of note in their magisterial tomes. But when it comes to us being parents, we don't know how to collapse that knowledge and make it applicable age appropriately for kids who are still like 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 years old. I think that for me is the battleground where the minds of our children are really handed over to those who seek to harm them. You know, I think that's where, you know, the battle should be. We should focus a whole lot more on that. You know, a lot of the scholars that all of us are already familiar with don't really look at children, I think, the way that we should, as, you know, as critical thinkers, as folk who want to talk about and engage with their world. You know, I've seen this with my son. I remember he was looking through his children's dictionary. You know, he's at the table. He reads all the books have food stains on them, which, you know, I'm supposed to tell him not to do that, but I never do. Anyway, so he's reading through his children's dictionary, and all I hear is the book slam shut. And he looks, you know, and I'm like, "Mario, what's wrong?" And he says, he's in tears now. Angry tears, because he's like, "Why do these people keep lying to me?" He had come across this picture of an artistic rendering of the building of the pyramids, and all of the people look European. So, you know, for his understanding that, you know, ancient Egypt was an African civilization of people who looked like him, the drawing didn't match his understanding of what he knew reality to be. So he was taught in talking back to the text, he dismissed what he saw as an untruth. Right? And and then again, we popped off and had a conversation. The improvisational nature of critical conversations is such that learning happens all the time. Another a good friend of mine is from Chile, and during a Democracy Now! Episode on September 11th, we got to talking about September 11th, 1973, when the Allende government was overthrown. And that led to my friend having to flee the country. You know, so he was able to see, and this was also backed by the United States government. So he was able to see what export terrorism looks like in real time, because his uncle was a victim of the U.S. Campaign of export terrorism in Chile. He had to leave his country. So he gets a very in-the-flesh understanding of what tyranny looks like when practiced by the red, white, and blue. And it is now affecting people he knows and cares for. So, again, these are the critical conversations that can pop off literally anywhere. Because we're not trying to have the development of the same type of child. Hmm. You know, some of our brilliant academics produced, you know, were physicists who produced bombs. You know, we laud Barack Hussein Obama for being the brilliant man that he is. But there are people in Somalia, Yemen, Afghanistan, Libya, Pakistan who would beg to differ because his brilliance is being used in the expansion of U.S. imperial hegemony. You know, and the blood of millions of people who happen to look like my son. Right? Yeah.
I was thinking about your process and how it's similar to some of the study that I'm doing now within First Nations community, where historically the practice of education was done by looking, learning, and listening. And also just to draw on the point that the process of educating Aboriginals was a form of genocide in a way, right? And erasure. And
continues to be.
And continues to be.
They are completely absent from the whole pedagogy.
Yeah. I just wanted to make that point, but I guess looking at you individually, in terms of the balance as a father who supports his children in an educational way from home as well as in the other areas, how do you create a balance for yourself in terms of, I mean, it sounds like it's full time, and not to put a negative spin on that, but how do you keep, you know, a balance for yourself emotionally, spiritually, physically, doing that work?
Good question. It's not just me.
Yeah.
It's not just me. It's also my partner. We're both 110% committed to dealing with the rearing of our children. So it's absolutely not just me. There's a lot of I get a lot of free time. she lets me out to play. but that's an important point. We have to find ways to, because, you know, capitalism is a coercive thing. So that means I don't get paid to be home developing the potential of my children, right? Mm-hmm. Reality is what it is. We've taken a financial hit, right? It's not unmanageable, thankfully. We're not living by candlelight, you know, under somebody's basement.
Mm-hmm.
But we're able to make it work, and that's because of partnership. And also, there's a larger community of folk who I'm building around and with, who are being built around us, and who I'm building with, who also take some of the responsibility for rearing our two sons, because they're not just ours. If we understand the African proverb that, you know, it takes a village, then in the 21st century manifestation, we have to start pulling folk who we are okay with giving our children over to, because they're not just our children.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the criteria for that inclusion in our children's lives is quite high.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we presume that if you are, we presume that what you bring to the table is so important to our children's development that you have to be in the house too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I take you as co-parent, as baba, as mama, because you are that valuable to my child's development. Like, I'm not an artistic guy. I'm not that dude. But I know folk who are. and who have love and concern for my children in the way that I have for theirs. They need to be in the clique, because I don't know how to do that stuff. I couldn't give a damn about drawing, but I know folk who do. You know, I know folk who are MCs. You know, who send me stuff, and I actually was running something that you would put out, and up until the certain words were said. But he enjoyed it. He enjoyed it. He enjoyed it. Because we need, and in the idea of music being made by people who live in the same city as my son is like, it blew his mind. Mm. It blew his mind. And he thinks of himself as a little MC. So the fact that his father is able to know somebody who spits lyrics, you know, it's pretty major. So we're bringing folk into his our children's experience that can enrich their knowledge base and stuff like that. So definitely, it's not just us. So yeah, I do get a lot of break time. I get recess and lunch.
I actually had an experience recently with I suppose one of my nephews. He is being unschooled. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of difficulty initially trying to conceptualize this, because I had this very rigid upbringing, and in the British school system, you know, where you get credits and your house benefits if you put the credits in the box and stuff like that. So, and my obsession with this child was, he's not going to get adequately socialized. And this became the only mantra that was echoing in my head, was there's an inadequate socialization going to go on. But what I was thinking socialization in my head was actually in many ways trauma that I experienced as a child, because you learn to be, you have to be smart. You have to be savvy when you're a child, right? In that kind of system, because you have to learn how to play it. You treat it like it's game. And so if you play
a predatory game,
very extremely, extremely. And what I was seeing unfolding in this child was a very different kind of socialization. He was being socialized to love. And it was profound to see the very different way he is shaped from this experience. And they're conducting this extraordinary experiment in which they're living with his grandparents and aunts and uncles. Mm-hmm. And they've kind of built this sort of hippie intellectual commune, and I'm so madly jealous of this child, and it's very beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And that's oh, good.
No, go ahead.
And that's that's the thing that always gets thrown out to me. What about the socialization? I'm like, damn, son, you don't remember your schooling? Mm-hmm. How terrible it was. That was really bad. If you were not in the in crowd, you knew what hell was like. And so I think we have, we've been conditioned, socialized, to believe that the socialization that takes place in school is actually healthy. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing could be further from the truth. I remember seeing kids who now, as 40-year-old adults, can say, yeah, I was gay. I'm like, dude, I knew that for a long time. But hell was what they experienced in school. That was their socialization. The folk who were slightly, who weren't particularly academically gifted in the school where I went, those folks were targeted. You know, you're dumb, this and that. The folk who weren't particularly athletic were ridiculed. If you happened to be fat, you were teased. So these are all the things that we learned between, you know, kindergarten and grade 12. That's what we learned. So for I remember talking to a principal whose name I will not utter on this station, and she asked a similar question about socialization, you know. And I said, because she's a family friend, I won't open up a can of whoop behind on her. But she missed the point, and I think we weren't being particularly honest about how horrific school can be for some children, you know. And just like the child that you had spoken of, my our son's socialization is very different, you know, is very, very different. He doesn't, there is no cliquishness, you know, he's hanging with me, he's hanging with some kids, you know, and there's no pressure on to be cool, you know, so he gets to be quirky, he gets to sit and read for 3 hours, you know, and nobody's saying, well, why are you reading a book all day, dude? Don't you want to do something cool? Mm-hmm. You know, he's able to do that and not be ridiculed for it. You know? Yeah. I think that's a very important thing.
I'm like, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, saying some of the things that we talk about as negative, like the basically bullying is what you're describing, right?
Yeah.
That's part of like the quote-unquote hidden curriculum of schools. because it's meant to create this kind of hierarchical society, right? That, you know, if you look at corporate structure, you look at athletic culture, you look at all these other things that big people do, they're hierarchical. So what we're really trying to teach kids are some, in some education set, formal educational settings, what we're really trying to reinforce is the idea, well, this is the real world, mm-hmm. right? People always say, well, it's great that you have this, you know, kind of, I remember my high school was like, it was very multicultural in a sense, right? There was a lot of ethnic groups who were there and kind of were working out and still living their kind of ethnicity in this place. And the teachers who are predominantly of European descent would be like, well, this isn't the real world. This isn't the real world. This isn't the real world. You need to get used to what the real world is like. You know, and so there's, I think, a message in that in terms of in the way that schools operate, these things that we look at as negative, as bad, and they are because they have negative effects on people. Society counts on them because society is, school is meant to reproduce the class structure. Mm-hmm. And so one of the, you know, reasons why education is such a political space and why you will have people, I'm sure you've gotten a lot of criticism for doing what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. Well, you'll have that. It's because we're all invested in this existing social model. And when you take children out of it, you're showing, I don't want to say alternative, but alternative, right? And you're taking some power away from the existing model. Right? And so that's, I found that's part of the challenge around schooling. And like between homeschooling, I've heard parents get a lot of heat for that. And also, like the whole talk of the Afrocentric school, regardless of, you know, whatever our views of it might be, the idea that we're creating these educational options that do not fit the dominant mold, people freaked out. You know, it's like, you can't take 40 black kids out of the school system. No way, you can't do that. You know, like that, this, people just lost their minds. And so it's like, what's really at stake? And it's the idea that, you know, this social hierarchy, this hidden curriculum, social domination, that's our actual secular religion.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you go against that, you're basically blaspheming.
Yeah. And previous to the Afrocentric school and the fight for the Afrocentric school, there have been a lot of alternative schools within the TDSB. This is not something mm-hmm. new. There have been lots of people who have said the current dominant system does not work for our child based on X, Y, Z, whatever mm-hmm. it is, right? So we understand that the system does not work for everyone based on different things.
Because I don't think it's natural for us to be indoctrinated in that way.
Yeah.
And that's one of the critical things about, you know, allowing for the opportunity to engage with your child in a way that doesn't, you know, patronize them, in a way that that allows them to look at that system of indoctrination in a critical way so that they're able to navigate, you know, and I think that is a much stronger preparation for the real world mm-hmm. is right. having an understanding of, you know, capitalism and colonization as the oppressive system that is and how it operates like, you know, a web. It covers everything. It permeates everywhere. And so if we want to be, absorbed into that and just sort of give into it and become, rather than resist, because resisting is difficult, right? As you say, there are sacrifices you have to make. If you want to stay at home with your child and educate them, you're clearly you have to make some tough choices. So a lot of us, I think, you know, because just for self-preservation, and we don't always necessarily see the other way, see the alternatives, just sort of give in to that indoctrination.
Okay. And there's also the idea of, like, rescue, class rescue. So, like, we're going to – I mean, anyone's from a colonial background or the Caribbean background, you know that you're the first one to go to college. You're the first one to go to this big school. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the idea is you're supposed to get in, get on, and hook everybody up, mm-hmm. right? That's why, you know, yep. granny's going to go with, you know, only corned beef for dinner or whatever the story is, right?
So you conquer that mountain.
Yeah, you mm-hmm. you climb that mountain, you get in there, and then you get your people on. That's the idea, right?
And it's considered quite an achievement to excel in that system, which mm-hmm. is so problematic as well.
Certainly, like the movie Sugarcane Alley, for example, like, you know, that I just kind of recently discovered, which is an old movie, is very much about yeah. that, where it's like, you know, here you have this child who's considered bright. And, well, you know, he lives in this kind of poor neighborhood where there's, he gets some type of schooling from cultural schooling, but how do you get, that's not going to get you out of poverty. No. So you're going to have to brave the system that we know is racist to some degree. And, like, you know, there's going to be people on the way who will help you, but you're going to have to brave this thing in order to lift your family, the people who supported you. And so in terms of talking about the school system and people who navigate it, I mean, we, there's something to be said about people who do that with the eye looking, quote unquote, back. I don't know if it's back, but who don't lose sight of that, who in some ways sacrifice themselves, who go through that in order to help mm-hmm. other people who might not have the same opportunity. And I think there's thousands of stories of that. And one more thing is the school system we have now, I think there's been a lot of changes in it that people aren't always aware of or know to take advantage of. Like the ability to, for students to determine curriculum, particularly in the high school level, is a lot higher than people seem to know or be aware of, you know?
Are you referring to an IED?
IEP.
IEP. Thank you.
Yeah. Not
IEP.
Canada rolling like that.
Individual education program.
Well, yeah, there's that, which, but also classes. I mean, if you have enough students to get together and say, you know what, we want a class on XYZ, because this actually happened at my high school in the 90s, and it was like, yeah, people got together and said, you know, we need a Black History program at this school, and they had to do it. Now there's even more things in place. If you know, if parents and students know to say, look, these are the things that we need to have happen. And schools, I imagine, are under the mandate to be more responsive to community. So community educators, there's options within, mm-hmm. you know, to work in these schools to help design and run these programs, you know, so it's I think that also parents should be aware of that option and students should be aware of that option as well.
I have to jump in here because we have to take a very quick break. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to The Vibe Collective. We are reasoning about education, looking at all the different models of educating our youth. That word, alternative education, homeschooling, critical engagement with the youth. And we're speaking with Junior Birchall. We are very happy to have him in the studio. We have to go to a very brief break. We will be back. Un momento, por favor, on The Vibe Collective CIT 89.5 FM.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back on The Vibe Collective CIUT 89.5 FM. As I said, it was going to be a brief break. It was very brief.
The mic's not working.
It's not working? No. Oh, well, your mic is on.
Oh.
So, yeah, we're talking about education and looking at different models of doing that. I want to get back to the question of socializing mm-hmm. because... you know, it's something I think, as Adnan was saying earlier, it's difficult for people who are indoctrinated to imagine mm-hmm. a world where you could possibly have it all for your child mm-hmm. through doing what you're doing. So do you want to talk about some of the, you know, you've mentioned that the opportunities for learning happen frequently. Mm-hmm. It's about an ongoing dialogue and conversation and allowing for different sort of tools. But in terms of explaining to the indoctrinated, you know, person who is unable to see, what would you say, in, you know, to convince them that that there is a possibility for a child to be socialized and schooled and educated and, you know,
all that I could
prepared?
Say. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, it's... Since the question does come up all the damn time, one thing that I would tend to say is that, you know, my children are around other kids all the time. Like, I haven't seen my son in 2 days, you know, my oldest one. And that's not parental negligence. He's just out hanging with his crew, right? And again, in developing village around our children, we were very deliberate in identifying folk who we could pull in and say, yeah, you could roll with these folk. But what that also meant was that I am equally invested in the development of their children, because every child is my child. So you know, as we allow them to socialize, you know, with others, we are also very much hands-on in nudging the trajectory towards somewhere healthy as far as the other children are concerned, right? So we don't just put them out there in the world and say, ah, have at it, young man. No, we are very much involved in the development of the cadre of youngins who surround our children. It's got to be, we have to be very proactive in this. There was, just by way of example, a couple of weeks ago, one of the kids, he's about 9 or 10, was running around the house, and I think he was making fun of the stereotypical Indian sound, right? So I was like, teachable moment right there. I'm going to let it go around. I'm going to catch him in the rinse. So, you know, I drew his attention to the fact that he is ridiculing people who fought very hard for the land that we are on. Just as our African ancestors, he came from the Horn of Africa, just as our African ancestors fought back against the European invaders. So you are making fun of the rebel? Who, sir, then are you? You know, just a little conversation. And I just left it. I just left it. So suddenly, just watching his play, his play acting change, he suddenly became the Indian with the weapon, shooting down the European. I just found that very interesting. You know, I didn't tell him what to think, but I just put a seed in his mind to, you know, just let that sit with you for a minute. Because we, you know, and again, he's in our space. So as socialization is taking place, I'm definitely, and we're definitely deliberately nudging that in a certain direction. I think that's important to do. We just don't cast them in the middle of a bunch of folk and say, you know, figure it out. I think that would be an act of parental neglect, you know. Yeah. Mm.
I think the other aspect that's very important is a sense of confidence on the part of parents as well, in that you are strong enough to handle this, that you can do this. Because I think in large part, when the kind of socialization that you'd have in the schoolyard is that you would see other children being picked on. You're like, okay, I don't want to be part of that, so I have to learn what I have to do to avoid that from mm-hmm. happening to me. And so, and infrequently it takes, like, at least in my case, it took intense introversion that mm-hmm. I just had to be separate from these things. Behave like a robot on the outside, on the inside, this sort of rich mm. life of the mind. But in the case of parenting, I find that this is like a reskilling as opposed to a de-skilling of parents, that you can engage your child and you can deal with trauma and difficult things with your children if you talk through it. Mm-hmm. And like, even in the case of, and I applaud you for not hiding these, because I'm going to pull in like some theory. Like, so Adorno says, like, that the precondition of justice is to allow suffering to speak. And so when you're talking mm-hmm. to your children about suffering in the world and the suffering in the world, you set up a child who's justice oriented. Yeah. And I think that's beautiful.
Yeah. Because he has to, if we want to see the sort, and this sounds really, you know, anyway, hippie-ish, I guess. If you want to see a transformation in the world that allows all of us to embody and accept and embrace and celebrate the fullness of our humanity, then we need children who are very progressive in their thinking, very committed to a politics of justice that is all-encompassing, right? And that's a very challenging thing to do. And I don't think that we find – and also I want this to be a visceral understanding. I don't want him to intellectualize this mm-hmm. as many of us do in universities when we come on – we come into contact for the first time with these theorists who come up with these highfalutin theories. I want my child to know that before he's done wetting the bed. Mm. I think that's where the seed of justice-mindedness must take root. You know, I think that's very important that we start as early as possible and then see where it takes us, you know, so that because I'm talking about my older one, the 8-year-old, his perspective is very much about aligning himself with, the wretched of the earth and also recognizing that we will win, that the ultimate triumph will be with those who are on the side of the right. And just seeing how he works this out in his head. I remember a couple of years ago, we were, you know, we've always been into, you know, like many parents and children, you know, the play. I never get to be like the winner. I'm always like the savage European coming in the mountains of Jamaica trying to hunt down Nanny, and he's licking shot at me, and I'm like, you know. But in his play world, he's acting out what what justice would look like, what resistance would look like. He's not aligning himself with the cowboy. He's very much the so-called Indian. He's not aligning himself with the plantation master. He's very much Harriet Tubman running and bringing folk with him, you know. And this was, again, deliberate with our three-year-old. He's so-called pre-literate. You know, we've tied his understanding of what heroism looks like to the iconography of, you know, people like, you know, the classic Che Guevara picture. So he has this book. You know, he goes through Che and Sister Nanny and Gaspar Yanga and Zumbi and Malcolm X and some others. And then at the end is a picture of him. Mm-hmm. He's like, Daddy, I'm a great freedom fighter too. Mm-hmm. So it's important for us to inject. Well, let me. It's important for us, meaning my partner and I, for our children to understand that they exist in this particular continuum, and also beyond that, that there is an expectation that you embrace what they embrace as well and take it to the next level. That's important because this is something that's ongoing. You know, they oppress, we resist, and we also, based upon our understanding of history, we create models that can take humanity in a different direction. And that sounds like a real highfalutin, you know, but ultimately that's what we want our children to do, I would think, if we take seriously the idea of freedom and justice and equality for all. If we take that seriously, then it should be reflected in the way that we rear our children.
I was also thinking about the importance of kind of creating a culturally educative environment, you know, that is somehow, for those people who are still, who raise their kids in institutions, like one of the ways to kind of contextualize or even counteract some of that institutionalized learning is creating a culture where those same things that are often not valued in institutions are valued, you know, so that critical thinking, which I think in some schools, in certain courses, is very much valued, right? But to have that reinforced at home in another kind of way, even in just the everyday interactions of culture, regular culture, you know, to have that, to have a place where knowledge is valued, to have a place where critical thinking is valued, where quote-unquote intelligence, however the many different ways it can manifest itself, right, is valued, and that's something that we hope to cultivate in others as a teen culture. I don't know how we get that done, but that's, I think, something where there's a lot of potential for growth, and a lot of times coming out of situations like homeschooling and wherever else where, you know, those can be hubs in terms of starting certain things off.
Actually, in my experience, when I was growing up, the freedom fighters who we were learning about were today's Taliban, because U.S. propaganda in places like Pakistan was very powerful about how Muslims were fighting against these godless Russians. And so, like, I remember actually when the Taliban sort of became a thing and they started hunting down the Sher of Panjshir and these, like, great warriors, which I had heard about, like this guy who faced down like a battalion of Soviet tanks and stuff like that. And then the Taliban started killing my childhood heroes. I was like, okay, these guys are dangerous. These these guys are very dangerous. but it's weird because at least like in the peripheries sort of the US empire, which I was a part of then, I found that the story that you were being told, the lies kept changing and evolving, and being able to see that as a child made me sensitive to how lies work and how they work in furtherance of something, especially official lies. So
official lies, that's something that has always you know, been a really big problem for me with the system that my daughter is in and learning in. Although, you know, I compensate a lot at home. Mm-hmm. We do have a lot of really critically engaged conversations. But just thinking about that idea of learning about freedom fighters, that's not even something that that language isn't even used in the education system. Mm-hmm. And when they look at somebody like, you know, for the pittance that they spend on Indigenous people here in Canada and the Canadian education miseducation system, there is, you know, I've referred to what she learned in grade three. It was horrible language in the history textbook about Aboriginal people were here first and then settlers built communities. Mm. And then they learn about Louis Riel in grade six. Mm. And Louis Riel is framed as a rebel, but the way it's framed, you know, certainly not a freedom fighter, certainly. And then again, you know, it's just that one post that they go to. Mm-hmm. And you know, people are indoctrinated to believe that, oh, well, there was Louis Riel, but at the end, you know. it just the way those things are framed is so problematic. And again, it really erases a whole group of people who are doing that work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then they become... You've mentioned a few times in this conversation, you know, it sounds hippie, and that's always something that has bothered me about mm-hmm. anything alternative, is that we are indoctrinated to believe that it's flaky and hippie yeah. to be, yeah. you know, chafing against the system in any kind of way. Mm-hmm. And so much so that, you know, freedom fighters are absent from, the curriculum. You don't learn about freedom fighters. I met some university students a few years ago through CIUT who didn't know what apartheid was.
What?
They did not know what apartheid was. They were reading from a script for an ad, and he said, apartheid? And I'm like, no, apartheid. And he literally asked, well, what is the apartheid? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, have you not heard about South Africa and you know, what happened there? And no, they hadn't. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there's this whole erasure of, you know, we know this. Mm-hmm. Those of us in the choir know about this, right? But to talk about it or to do any kind of work against that, as you say, it's viewed in this way that's, mm-hmm. You know, it's not validated. It's looked at as being a hippie.
The only reason I know about apartheid is because my parents were talking about it. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't really talk about it in school. And this was, you know, in the 80s when it was actually happening, you know. And it wasn't really, you know, it wasn't making it into anybody's real lesson plans. You know, so like the idea that home culture and peer culture mm-hmm. is something that educates was always something very, you know, in the front of my mind. I mean, my dad, who's an educator, he would always say, well, school is like practice. Or no, school is like more like the stage. Like you actually learn stuff mm-hmm. outside of school, if it's quote-unquote homework or whatever else. And you bring that to this place to collect your credits, get your grade, whatever. But that's not necessarily what's going to determine your learning. You know, that's a place that might help structure learning in a certain way, set up particular tasks that may be helpful or may not be helpful. But school is not to monopolize your learning. Like that's mm-hmm. just like 10% of what's supposed to happen. But I find a lot of time is that school becomes synonymous with education. Yeah. And it's not. And if you look at most of the quote-unquote educational theorists, they're like, no way. Like, you know, school is this. Education is this much larger, holistic thing. Yeah. And so I think, again, I feel it's really important that we create a culture in education, an educative culture that really brings up things like apartheid and makes the connections to the other things in the world, because the school's not really trying to do it. I mean, for the most part, it's the state, and the state is going to fund things that are going to generate
itself.
Right, reinvent itself, mm-hmm. right, recreate itself. So if it's going to be, you know, the whole idea with school now was like, I've read articles like this, you know, in universities, like, don't come to university expecting an education. They're telling you this in university. Yeah. They're saying, I come here to get qualified, mm-hmm. you know, to get qualified to do whatever. But it's not, it's training, it's this, but it's not really education. Yeah. You shouldn't really ask us to do that. That's a bit out of our jurisdiction.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, well, what are you left with? Yeah.
I think especially when we're in this situation, and I don't know all the details of Bill C-115, but wherein I feel like, you know, our teachers who are teaching our young people. I mean, at first when I when I heard some of the stuff that the teachers were fighting for, I was thinking about, you know, that's not necessarily, I mean, that's not the real world, right? But then I thought about, these people are teaching my children. If they need to have that many days off a year for their mental health, hey, because I know I couldn't do that all day, right? And these are the things we need to rethink about education, who is educating our children. Having said that, we all understand there are some people in the education system that probably should not be there.
Some is an understatement. Mm-hmm. But not only that, it makes me think about, I live in this horrid, homogenous neighborhood. And when I was at home with my daughter when she was quite young, all of the people I was meeting in the playground were nannies. Mm-hmm. And it always struck me as odd that, you know, I mean, these are great people that I met, and I made some really good friends there, but it always struck me as odd that, you know, these people are hired, they go into, you know, the home of the elite to raise mm-hmm. their children. Those elite CEOs and business people would likely not hire those same people into their companies, you know, and that it's one of those things that really, you know, when you think about that, it just, what you were saying about the people who are educating and the quality of the educators, it also just makes me think about how, you know, this homogeny views children, and that British, anyone who's of Caribbean descent or in a colonial British, coming from that colonial British background, knows probably children should be seen and not heard. That was how my father was raised in Jamaica. It was like, you can be seen, but you cannot speak, you can't hear. Mm-hmm. And there's just this real devaluing of children and youth. And it's, you know, completely the opposite of what we're hearing a lot about, and what those of us who know Indigenous paradigms is, where we actually really empower our youth, and we really value our youth, and we in particular look at seven generations ahead. And I just think it's really interesting to make those, you know, to make those connections, as you're saying, like who is educating our children? What are their own personal politics, right? And how often do those personal politics infiltrate into the classroom? But then also, you know, when you look at who these people have their children, and then they just give them over to somebody else.
And I want to make it clear that for me, this is not necessarily a race or gender thing. I think that there are some educators within the system who look like me, who do not necessarily share my politics on the way children should be raised. And I think it's I know that there are educators within the system who are trying to do things differently, but there are a lot of people, it's a job, it's a means to an end, and it's a secure job as well. And I really, really applaud you, Junior, and your partner, and your circle of folks who are trying to do this work, because we need that, you know, and I have godchildren who are moving into that system, and I'm just like, what can I do, you know, to kind of balance or counteract that? Because it's a scary thing. I mean, I think I got out of the system relatively unscathed, but I also had parents who were up in administrators' faces when they saw that I wasn't being treated the way they presumed my intelligence to be, right? Mm-hmm. But that's a lot of work, especially for working class folks of color in Canada who are immigrants, right? Like, it's a lot of work, you know, so.
And it can be a lot of violence because of the racism that is in the administration, right? Yeah. And how people are streamlined through particular classrooms. And there's a real denial within the administration of any kind of oppression. I mean, if you were to suggest that, you know, you'd be dealing with a very entitled and privileged response, probably.
A lot of times, if you do have, like, again, like an organized parent group, they can exert a lot of, I guess, you know, control. I won't say control, but influence, certainly, over the school. So one of the things, I don't know, I remember before, I don't know if it still happens now, is that you'd have, like, you know, people, different communities, they'd have someone who'd go in to advocate with the parent, you know, someone who's very familiar with the school system, to be like, well, we know that the expectations are this, and we haven't seen this, or who can speak in teacher speak. so as to get the point across or speak to VPs or admin, etc. And I think that's the formation of and maintenance, sustaining of those types of I don't want to call them institutions, it's just kind of networks or whatever, mm-hmm. what have you, are very important to people getting getting what they deserve out of the education system and what they're, you know.
I think that's very important because I feel like under the rubric that we're talking about before, that there's an expectation that you go into the system and succeed and do better for others. You have parents who come in and who have been told that, you know, your child goes to school and they are reared in a certain way and it's always in their benefit. And then they're in Canada and they realize that's not like home, but they don't have the skills to navigate the system. So I think, you know, kind of advocacy and support work is really what we need. And you know, there's some double agents that can do that work behind the scenes. Maybe they can't necessarily go, but they can advise someone who's going to advocate for or support parents in that way, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's been this recognition, at least in the case of the law, when now you have divorce proceedings, that that you're almost encouraged to have a guardian ad litem to represent the child's interests as well. It's separate from the interests of the parents, that the child would have a one-on-one person who they would engage with and talk to. And then the guardian would then submit sort of a sense to the court about like how this should play out. And I think that's really important because children speak differently and they need to be listened to very differently than an adult. And it's very hard to hear a child who hasn't learned to find their voice, especially if they're in a home that's got like some tumult or what have you. And although you'll hear a lot of people, like if you raise this suggestion to a couple that's going through a divorce or something, they'll just think it's absolutely ridiculous. Right. They're like, well, we've already decided where the kid goes. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, we are at the end of the hour. We can keep going, but I have to take a break. DJ Griffin had a mix that we would like to get to at some point as well, as myself, DJ Jams. But I feel like we haven't finished this conversation. So, Junior, are you able to stick around for a little bit longer? Okay, so we're just going to go to a break. You're listening to The Vibe Collective, and we'll be back after these messages on CIUT 89.5 FM.
It's named Good Catch the General Store.
We are a convenience store. We're open 10 to 10 daily.
The store is on Queen Street West.
In the heart of Parkdale, we're a true Parkdale gem. We're a true social enterprise. So many people come into our place and say, what is this place? I love it. What do kids like about the Good Catch General Store?
Toys. And our chocolates.
And what do the big kids like about Good Catch?
Let's see. There's like food. Organic, fur-free groceries, and so much more.
That's very good, son.
That's very good, son.
Music Africa and Gladstone World present free February Friday night concerts celebrating Black History Month and the year of the 25th annual Afrofest. Discover Africa in the heart of Toronto. Every Friday in February at the Gladstone Hotel, 1214 Queen Street West. February 1st. Don A. Roberts. Info at musicafrica.org. Sponsored by Music Africa and CIUT. Bringing you 25 years of Afrofest.
This is CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto community radio station. Broadcasting live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. From Heart House, University of Toronto.
Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your co-host, Jams. Joining me in studio, my co-hosts,
Mally, a.k.a. Docu Vixen,
Adrian Worrell,
Kemba King.
And we're saying goodbye to Adnan. Goodbye, Adnan. And we're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, normally we have roundtable discussions. We talk about important issues like social justice, decolonization, the culture of resistance, identity, education, miseducation, indoctrination, all those Asians. And and then from 4 to 5, normally, one of the resident DJs brings you music to move you. This is, I think, our third or fourth week in a row now that we've really been messing with that. No, that's okay. Hopefully the listeners
understand and appreciate the discussion. Last week we heard from a bunch of them saying, yes, keep talking. So we'll just keep it rolling for now. We're speaking with Junior Burchell, who is an educator, a writer, and then some other good things that you had in your bio there, Kim.
Sorry, you're looking at me and I'm like, uh-huh.
You have his bio in front of you.
I will in about 10 seconds. So he is a literary specialist, a public speaker, a freelance writer, and author of several books. I wanted to, I guess, ask not necessarily something that I would ask, but probably the naysayers would ask, in that, you know, what happens if one of your children decides that they want to be a part of the dominant school system? Has that been a discussion that you and your partner and other members have discussed?
Of course, part of engaging children as independent thinkers means that, you know, you have to leave room for them to decide whatever the heck they wish. And so Amari's, you know, we talk about, you know, whether he would want to go. And at this point, he's like, no, man, I love staying home.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. I love hanging out with my... He said that.
Yeah.
You know? He didn't even say that to me. You know, this was something that he told to somebody else who then, you know... But, yeah, that wouldn't be a problem if he decided, you know what, let me just try the school thing. And folk who unschool... because actually I would call what we do life learning.
Life
literally
learning.
Learning from life.
Perfect.
Folk who do this sort of thing sometimes have children who say, you know what, I want to, what's this high school thing about? Let me just go there, you know, and they have maybe a year in conventional miseducation or longer. It's up to them. So this is something that, again, requires that there's not a cookie cutter solution that is being brought to bear on young folk. Rather, it's assuming, again, as I said at the outset, that our children are able to think. And sometimes what they think may not be in alignment with what you would like them to think. But hey, that's what independence looks like from mm-hmm. time to time. Right? Mm-hmm. So if he were to decide to go, then with our blessings, he'd go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the recognition that we have armed our children with the ability to critically interrogate the stuff that they're being given.
Mm-hmm.
And when you inoculate children, because it's an inoculation, what we experience in school is akin to being thrown into a hotbed of viruses, a chemical cocktail of toxins. You know, maybe I'm being a bit hyperbolic, whatever. But it's not necessarily for the good of children, right? But if they are suitably inoculated, they can go literally wherever they wish. But our job as parents is to root them deeply in who they are so that their branches can spread far and wide. And so that they're not washed away by the dominant tsunami-like culture, you know, that really puts them at the bottom of any hierarchy, of any social order. That's where they'll be found, as African people, as peoples of color. And if we want to do something different, then, well, I should say, if they want to then pursue a different track, we are comfortable in our in the work that we have done up to that point to let them go.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm. I feel like I'm just thinking about how, you know, parents and children who decide that life learning is the process, therein redefine what success can and does look like. And I'm thinking about a recent video that was put out by the Inside Project, I think it's called, where Kim Kitchen Crosby talks about her process of, you know, essentially, you know, having a hard time during her schooling in both primary school and high school. And then she headed to university, where she decided that it wasn't a space in which she could improve her learning. And she was then, you know, advised by a professor that she didn't need to do that. And for anyone who's listening outside of the Toronto area, you know, Kim is a very bright and gifted speaker and poet, and has very critical ideas on what the system looks like, and has been a guest of the Vibe Collective. So it we have clear examples of people who did not necessarily go through the system at every stage and have produced a redefinition of what success looks like outside of a capitalist model.
That being said, as someone who has also not succeeded in the system, I dropped out of high school at the age of
16, 17, I tried to go back, and I'd gone to, you know, four different high schools in my entire career, and ended up not graduating. Went on to do a pre-U course here at U of T, which allowed me to get in. But then again, it's you know, it was struggling in that paradigm, and because I was taking Aboriginal studies and was blessed with some really outside of the box professors, and also in the Caribbean Studies program as well, Arnold de Toiro being one of them.
Yes.
But even still, I mean, it, you know, there's a real struggle. And then when you don't fit in, where do you go?
Right.
Where do you go for a career? Where do you go for your livelihood?
And how do you feel about yourself?
Exactly. Exactly. Because you're constantly being invalidated if you don't fit in. Yeah. And if you are on the fringe. And then again, there are a whole bunch of stigma that come with that as well, in terms of, you know, not being a suit and tie type of person, or, you know, having even how you wear your hair, if you wear your hair in dreadlocks, or if you have, you know, a particular, anything that goes against that grain, it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. So how do you prepare your young ones for that, in terms of, you know, not that we want to, I think, make people feel like they have to fit in, but understanding that there will be a pushback on them for not fitting in.
Of course. I mean, I think the pushback is occurring and has been occurring for some time. You know, the mere idea that your children don't go to a conventional school, you know, that was tough for our relatives to deal with. You know, I was on the phone with my mother. She's a, you know, 70-something-year-old Bajan, you know, and yeah. So, you know, so she's speaking to her 4-year-old grandson, and she's like, "Boy, you better get him in school." The saving grace in our particular instance is that I'm a highly trained educator, so that in their minds, they say, well, you know, he went to an elite school, he did his thing, he's got his grad degree. Therefore, what he's doing at home probably looks, you know, absolutely identical to what they would get in a regular school, because he's got the training, right? So that's given us a bit of flex room for me to do some, you know, wacky way out stuff that they don't know about. Right? the reality is this. If we are serious about creating an environment where our children think about the world in radically different ways than the status quo would bless, then we have also got to realize that there is very little payout associated with those who are challenging the dominant order. Very little payout. You don't get rich off of this, right? So necessarily that means that our understanding of what success looks like will not be mirrored by, say, Oprah Winfrey or, you know, Bill Gates or any of those types of folk who've become very materially successful following a certain path, you know. So academia ideally should produce children who grow into adults who are very well trained, who can slot into these predetermined areas. Oh, he's a lawyer. Oh, that's good. Oh, he's a doctor. Oh, that's excellent. You know, or whatever, you know, like I'm sure my mother would love to have seen, you know, because he's reading at high school level and he's doing algebra without writing down all of these cool things that would win him lots of props in a regular school. But yet he's talking about, you know, the Black Panther Party, and he's questioning what this guy Obama's doing in the so-called Middle East. Why is he doing that? Why are you doing that? What are you trying to, how is he going to get paid? How is this little Negro going to get paid? That's the real question. That's the real question, because that's what determines, especially coming from the Caribbean. We want children who are successful, who are making money, who become Queen's Counsel, who do all of those big things, who are chocolate-covered white folk, essentially. That's what our definition of success really is, if we want to get real about it, right? We don't want that, though. We don't want that. Mm-hmm. And so our children are being, you know, groomed for movement in a different direction. As I said earlier, we need children who will grow into adults who recognize that all of us need to be permitted the full breadth and depth of our humanity. All of us. And as it stands now, the system as it stands now does not allow for that. In fact, militates against it, right? But if you want to go that path, then you have to ascribe to something higher than that. Mm-hmm. There are principles, you know. What does truth look like? Justice. And, you know, the ancient Kemites came up with the idea of ma'at, truth, justice, righteousness, harmony, balance, order, and reciprocity. The indigenous peoples of this land have a similar understanding. My success cannot be disconnected from your health and well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we need folk who take that, again, I had mentioned earlier, viscerally, not intellectually. I want you to understand that here. And I want that to dictate how you move through the world. Right? So for us, that is critical. And if our children are able to grasp that in a deep, you know, deep sense, then that is success to us. Because we understand that they will not turn predator for paycheck. And I think that is... again, we don't know what they will do. We don't know what they will become. But we know what sort of fertilizer we have added to the soil. And some good stuff. I mean, of course, we're criminally biased, but we think it's good stuff. And we want them to grow based upon what we have put in. Where the branches will end up, I don't know. But I do know that the way things are now, with the sort of indoctrination that is received, not just in school, but in the larger society, is taking us nowhere good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you know, children these days, or the children that I interact with, are so, and I admittedly spend time with, you know, children of color, they are wildly brilliant,
yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And I think I have this conversation with the people at least once a month that I have to be careful what I say. Because I have to remember that they're still 4 or 7 mm-hmm. or 8, and there are some things that they don't necessarily understand, or that my own biases being raised within a certain system will limit them, you know? And mm-hmm. it's the kind of thing that makes me change different things about myself. Like, I no longer ask people, not that I did a lot, but now I'm very cognizant of it, what do you do? Like, that mm-hmm. question. And when people mm-hmm. ask me that, I'm like, you mean like my paid 9-to-5 job? You mean like what I do when I'm home alone? Like, you know, what are those things? Or like when people ask me what school I went to, I'm not going to necessarily shy away from it, but it's not the definition of the person that you are looking at in particular, because you're asking me that for a reason, because it carries some sort of societal or cultural weight where it doesn't for me, right? So I think that we have to really look at our children's brilliance and really work towards those models that are within and without the current dominant system, because there are some great things, I think, happening within the system when we look at the, you know, culturally specific models like First Nation school, you know, that are people are taking from that and pushing the TDSB, like you were talking about earlier, to create a curriculum that more meets different class and culture and religious needs.
I also remember growing up, like, there's always this kind of reverence for people who, quote unquote, made it, like, oh, can you believe this guy's the head of surgery at so-and-so, and he was just a guy from Guyana. Like, there was that talk, but that person wasn't necessarily considered more than the person who taught themselves electronics or who taught themselves how to wire, you know, a house or whatever the situation. I mean, like, if they did it really, really well, like, I mean, you know, like... And I remember also getting a sense of, like, seeing people around who looked, quote-unquote, plain, you know, whatever exactly that means. But then, you know, my dad in particular having this great reverence, like, oh, you don't know that guy, he can, he knows music, like, by ear. Or so there was a sense of values and skills that were beyond, that were just beyond, you know, the kind of systemic ones that we get. And, you know, part of my concern with a lot of the, quote-unquote, black discourse is that restrictive element of it, where it's like, unless you have this, this, and this, which is defined by these people who have historically oppressed you, then you're really not, you haven't really done much with your time, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's like, I wonder how that shift came about, where there was, it seemed before, you know, a lot of space for people who are skilled in whichever capacity, and perhaps putting them on par in certain ways with people who had class status, to kind of, even if you have skills, as long as if you're not getting paid for it, you know, if it doesn't make dollars, it doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Like that kind of mentality, and like how that's been anti-educative in a huge way. One of the things too with regards to education is that, you know, people who are in business, they'll tell you like they don't teach you. Well, they have business classes, but they don't really teach you how to be economically or financially thrifty in schools per se. Like they create workers and consumers, and like going forward in terms of creating a sustained community, sustained village, it's like how can that village finance itself? On what skills? What sense with? How does it participate in the money economy? How does it not participate in the money economy? How is it able to provide for itself so that you don't have some people who have to say, okay, well, you know what? We had this, but now we're going to have to do the Sugarcane Alley thing, which is take my brilliance, go inside the system, and now see what we can harvest from that because we're not being able to generate these resources. Because, I mean, if we look at how education is now, it's for most people, it's a primarily economic thing. That's the bounding. So, like, what's the step in terms of educating young people so as to create, alternative, but different ways of relating economically in the system so that doesn't later close the door on certain things for them?
I think the important seed to sow has to be done early. I think we learned all about, hierarchy and capitalism and how to win over other people. We learn about competition and cutthroat competition and the rewards that come for those who are victorious. We learn all that before we age 10. We learn all of that before we reach age 10. And quite often, the cultures that many of us come out of have alternative ways of framing community that recognize the necessity of communal, the interconnectedness of all the parts for the common good, right? And that shows up in the ways that the children in these communities would be socialized, so that when they are adults, they're not going to consider it to be a good thing, a positive, for them to engage in some sort of coercive practices to get over on the next man or woman. But again, that has to be set very, very, very early in life. And I don't think we give that nearly enough weight as far as so-called African-centered scholarship. We don't think about the ways that we can use the lessons from history and our understandings of the lessons from history to determine how our children are reared. Quite often we default to the theoretical. So, for example, your kid comes out knowing that there are 2,300,000 stones, each weighing about 2 to 3 tons, that went into the making of the Great Pyramid. So what the heck? This ain't friggin' Jeopardy. Not the Daily Double. We're not making use of, in other words, we're not making meaningful use of the information that's stored in a study of history. And as a result, our children, and I've seen this time and time again, they come to these forum churches, you know, and where some resident kente cloth wearing scholar from the United States regales the crowd with all manner of polysyllabic terminology and all sorts of other claptrap. But then the children are so disconnected. So what are you passing on as far as knowledge beyond some sort, beyond entertainment? Right? Because your children don't see anything different, because your children are being raised and reared and shaped and guided by a dominant status quo that says, we are disconnected. And as to the extent that you are disconnected and successful, then that's a good and positive thing. You don't have to worry about the people next to you. They don't really matter for much. And that which makes money makes sense. That's what we learn. That's really what we learn. And again, I really take issue with those who call themselves African-centered scholars for the fact that they don't focus in nearly enough on children.
So I'm just looking at some of the comments that came up after that post, and there's a question about why aren't you writing a book? And is that something that you intend upon doing since you are an author and and very very articulate in various ways.
I'll say this, and I'm glad that my publisher isn't really a fan of Facebook. Anyway, I have some other, I'll just say I have some other writing things that I'm supposed to be knee-deep in. But that is something that I'll definitely be looking for, looking towards doing under the cover of darkness on my own time. Because I also think that, you know, initially I was searching out, you know, scholarship around stuff that my partner and I were trying to do with our children, because I was figuring that, of course, somebody's been writing about this, right? I just haven't stumbled across the text. And I'm still looking. Maybe, you know, I'm just the eternal optimist like that. I just presume that somebody's written about how do you culturally support your children at very early, at, you know, very young ages to grow them in a very specific way. And essentially, I've found that I'll probably have to be the one who will author that text. And because I think, you know, from the lived experience of being home every day and engaging questions from, you know, a 4 and an 8-year-old, it's given me a level of awareness about what works and what absolutely does not, and what children in my circle can handle and absorb and stuff that others who don't have immediate access to their children in the way that I do probably wouldn't have be privy to. Yeah.
You have your children are both boys. Do you think that your life learning style is shaped around that, or do you think that, you know, if you had a girl or someone who was trans-identified, that that would shift your teaching style, for lack of a better word?
Okay. That's not the word I would use.
Okay.
It's not, I'm not teaching as much as we're conversing, we're talking,
right,
we're reasoning, we're grounding.
Right.
The learning environment would change depending on the elements within the circle. So yeah, if there were a girl in there and I, you know, if there were a girl in that space, we're just parents of two and that's it.
Yeah.
Just two. Yeah. But if we added a female, I think the energy would shift depending on what she brings into the space. Most definitely. And, you know, were that child to be trans-identified, all of those elements would cause necessary shifts in the way that we relate, you know, because the conversation is, you know, dependent on what each person brings and contributes to the circle of learning.
Yeah. One of the things in, you know, one of the things they teach you in education, but you often practically don't get a chance to do it because you have like 35 kids in the class or whatever situation might be challenging, is that to really get a sense of how each child's mind works, you know, and in elementary school, you might have a better chance to do that because it's a year you have with them and they're, you know, younger children tend to be in certain ways more open, you know. Teenagers, you know, they got to be cool, right? So it's a whole different thing. But to really get a sense of how they understand, how they make sense of the world, not only what's important to them, what their motivations are, but, you know, how they associate things. And so the idea is that, you know, education is supposed to be kind of custom-made, tailored to people's minds.
Yeah.
In a sense. So in as much as gender affects the way that people think, you know, that's going to change the dynamics of any kind of educational setting to that degree. But
necessarily,
ideally, you know, and it, lots of things happen which prevent this oftentimes, is how does this child, this person, make associations? Do they make it through the visual plane? Do they make it kinetically? Because, like, I mean, again, theoretically, you could teach someone calculus through in gym.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know. So does the body teach them? Does the do the eyes teach them? Do the ears teach them? You know. So what are the ways that they make those associations, and what are the connections between those associations to get the most out of them? And like that's part of the trick of teaching. But a lot of times in institutional settings, you know, particularly as I recall in my time as a high school teacher, it's like, we have this curriculum to get through. We have 20 weeks.
Yeah.
you better find your way through it. Let's go.
You're on the track.
Let's go. Yeah, let's go. Like, every day is something new. Mm-hmm. And some kids actually thrive in that.
Yeah.
You know, some people do. And, you know, they like the challenge, like the quiz. They get up for it. Like, that's their thing, the way they're – and mm-hmm. they more power to them. But to suggest that because someone doesn't work in that environment, that they are there's something wrong with them, mm-hmm. is the real tragedy. Because we know, as educators and as people, anybody, you know, that you have to really speak in that kind of learning language. We have to learn that child's learning language mm-hmm. in order to really teach them. But that's a phase that's often, you know, that oftentimes gets overlooked.
I really appreciate you bringing up that point. It's something that we see too many students falling into the cracks because they don't fit in, mm-hmm. And they're lost, and they often tend to be, I think, exceptional in a lot of really brilliant ways. It's just, you know, that exceptionality that won't allow them to fit into that paradigm.
One more thing is with particularly, like, I mean, people often think of getting getting your child tested, and they get tested as gifted, that's always a good thing. Mm. It not always, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot that can go on with that, and mm-hmm. particularly in a very structured school system where it's like three absences or three lates, you get a detention or mm-hmm. zero or what have you. Mm-hmm. I was reading this book, it's called Deschooling Society, an old book, and he's talking about like the kind of, he didn't use this phrase, but the kind of tyranny of obligatory attendance. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that you have to have your body needs to be in this building at this time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What's the hidden curriculum in that?
Yeah.
Like, what are they really teaching you in that? It's like, well, I can do the work here, I can do the work like this. No, that's not good enough. Mm-hmm.
You need to toe the line.
Right. And these are the only ways that you can get this information, and that's it. And so, you know, all of these little things that we take up as sometimes just the simple things that are outside of learning are actually part of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And we often don't interrogate them. And so people who could otherwise be very, and I've actually seen this, people who are actually very competent because of the bullying they might see, because of the other kind of like structural things, they're kind of, you know, there's a term, pushed out of the system. Mm-hmm. You know, then we look at them and say, oh, what's wrong with them? And it's like nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the system is not designed to maximize the potential of those who must endure it. It's, you know, it needs a regular, a certain set amount of cast off. You know, it needs that. And with my own personal experience being the at home, Amari, my 8-year-old, he happens to be a reader. Right, so since he started reading, I think he's been spending at least 2 to 3 hours independent, all on his own, reading every single day. Right? So what I grew into the habit of doing is just throwing books on the floor the night before, and just, you know, if he picks it up, he does. If he doesn't, eh. And so I would leave a book on the floor, and by breakfast time, he's in it, you know. And then he's asking me questions, you know. So, but he's a reader. In a regular school setting, folk would be like, oh, yeah, he's, you know, that's a real boon for him to be able to read as well as he does and articulate himself as well as he does as well. Now, the 4-year-old is very artistic. And this isn't something that's celebrated in the school setting. So we're very like, pictures are very important to him, and being able to replicate images and stuff like that, it's a big deal. So what that means in my own de-schooling process, because I too have my particular bias. I'm biased towards the word, the written word. I could, you know, like Amari, I could read all the live long day. But what happens when you have a child who doesn't fit your particular bias? Right. And again, part of this process is my unlearning my learning. Very important to do. And I think Adrian mentioned, you know, schools aren't designed to really listen to what a child brings. You know, you shoot for the middle as an educator and hope that those who are below can pick it up, and those who are up ahead can at least not get so bored that they cause a disruption in the classroom. That's really what happens in the class. So as educators, as parents, it's up to us to really challenge our own expectations and listen to the uniqueness that our children bring to bear on their learning environment, and really to respect that. You know, they're different. They're universes unto themselves. Mm-hmm. And we have to recognize and celebrate that and recognize that their genius is passed through this particular prism. Right? Yeah, I think that's very important.
I think that's a great way for us to end off, you know, with reverence for our children.
Mm-hmm. I just want to add really quickly before we sign off. We've been asked, you know, we've been wanting to do this, like, you know, list kind of events that's going on. Okay. So Zainab, who is an honorary collective member.
And an educator.
And an educator.
And an unschooler.
Yes. Yes. And has on Thursday a workshop called From Inclusion to Centralization, Trusting Your Own Wisdom Traditions. And it's going to be at 2 p.m. To 3:15 p.m. at York Lanes at York University. And it's going to explore how emerging sciences validate some practices in indigenous and other wisdom traditions. Mm-hmm. So,
and
go check
also
that
she,
out.
She'll be doing a workshop, a similar workshop on the Vibe Collective coming up. I think it's February 16th.
Yes.
I believe that's the date. Yes. Yeah. So we're really looking forward to having her back for that because she talks about some really critical things for people to have awareness of in terms of the power that we carry in our bodies and how indigenous knowledge has always empowered that power. But it has been oppressed by colonization.
Yes. So if you want to get a live version of that, go to York Lanes. Yeah, doesn't York Lanes. I'm assuming that there'll be like
signage.
Yes,
York Lanes isn't that big.
Yeah, no, it's true. And then the second one is on February 9th, and it's called "Revolutionize Your Valentine's Day: Radical Love and the Spirit of Social Justice." And that's taking place at 90 Eglinton Avenue East, and that's put on by Maywork, so you can actually go and check that out, and it's pay what you can.
Nice.
The York Lane ones is free.
Nice.
And if you want more information, you could contact Zainab at amadahy@rogers.com.
Thank you.
Yes.
We'll keep those event listings coming, hopefully.
Yes. And if people are in, there's actually something going on today. It's a candlelight vigil for Bridget Taki at Eglinton West End. I think it's Eglinton. I didn't write down the number. Eglinton and...
I can look it up really quick here. And also, I want to give a shout out while I'm looking that up. I want to give a shout out to the people who went on the water walk today for Idle No More. As the resistance continues, there are all kinds of gatherings and teach-ins. And there's the weekly teach-in that happens at Council Fire every Tuesday at 6 p.m., and today there was a gathering. It was a water walk, and so I want to give thanks to everybody who attended that and who keeps the fire burning for this resistance movement that is Idle No More. We're with you. And then the candlelight vigil that you were speaking of. Where is it? Here it is for Bridget Taki. It's at Eglinton Avenue West in Martin Grove,
right.
Willow Ridge. It's 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. That is not today.
No,
oh, yeah,
it is
that
today.
Is today. The yeah, no, sorry. The funeral is next Saturday, yeah. But that's the candlelight vigil today. And so our thoughts are with her family and friends. And we will, DJ Griffin can drop a little bit of... there's only 20 minutes left in the show. He can drop a little something for 20 minutes.
Yeah, that mysterious DJ Griffin.
Yes, he's very mysterious, DJ Griffin. He's the strong, silent type.
Yeah, who could it be?
He curses a lot.
He does curse a lot, though. You are right.
Yeah.
So, Junior Burchill, It was a pleasure having you here with us today.
Yeah, it was good.
It was.
I got out of the house and I found found a new place.
Nice. Well, next time, please do bring your sons. Or, you know, if not, if the younger one, if it wouldn't interest him, mm-hmm. perhaps the elder son would be interested in joining us. We'd love to. We do, you know, we haven't heard enough from the youth in a long time. We used to bring youth on every so often, mm-hmm. my own youth included. but not my personal youth, my child. It would be great to have you. My youth is always present. It would be great to have you back. And okay. and as I said, you know, you're always welcome to bring your family mm-hmm. and certainly yourself as well. We'd like to have you back.
Cool.
Yeah. So thank you for coming through. And we'll let DJ Griffin sign off because we've really pushed it. We have to go to a quick ID break and then DJ Griffin will come on the other side. So big shout out to once again to everybody standing up against the system. We are all about resisting in intelligent ways, and that's what we do every week here on the show. And thank you to my co-hosts.
Yay.
Yeah. Thanks for organizing this one, Kemba.
Yes, oh, thank no you, Kemba.
Yeah.
yeah. So, did you have something you wanted to say?
No. Bye from Kemba King.
Yes, bye.
Yeah. Nice. Okay. All right. Well, yes, thank you to the listeners. Thank you to everybody who tweeted at us, Posh Q Bird, V Grant. There were a couple of other people in there. I'm sorry if I'm missing you, but thank you very much for listening. Check us out on the intranet, vibecollective.wordpress.com, @vibecollective for Twitter. Like us on Facebook. We'll like you back. Until next time, peace. One.